And please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Brian from the Conscious Contact Group in Doylestown.
Okay. Does the microphone sound good? Everybody hear me okay? A little bit closer? Better? All right, sounds good. My name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank the group for asking me to come up here tonight. What can I say? It's really a privilege and an honor to be asked to share for AA. I was thinking on the way up here, we were talking about this at a meeting I was at last night, how when I was in my first treatment, I remember they said, you know, are you living or are you existing? And when I got brutally honest with myself, which I did in many ways, I'm sure, which I'll talk about at the time, that hit me really hard because the reality of my life at that time was I was not contributing in any meaningful way, providing anything positive to the lives of anybody around me. You know, alcoholism took me to this place where my world got so small and I was so isolated that just that, I didn't have anything to offer for the people around me, and I thought the best thing I could do was just push everybody away, you know, and it's just, I identified with that. I was literally existing, you know, just to get myself from one drink to the next, you know. That was the way I felt. And what a difference it is today, man. You know, I can show up for AA and I just have meaningful relationships with people. I come here, I get to socialize. Like I said, I get to have relationships with people. I get to meet people that I care about. I get to provide for them and, you know, their journey through this thing and help them. And I get to help reach out and help the newcomer and come do stuff like this and hopefully offer a message to people that are getting involved with this thing, you know, and put out there a message that would have helped me, you know, and that's really the how and why of it all is coming to AA and being of service and make sure that it's there and it's available for people in the way that it was available for me. You know, I'll go through my story to the best of my ability, go through and talk about, you know, what it was like, what happened and what it's like now. But, my sobriety date is May 7th of 2014. So, just a couple of weeks ago, I was lucky enough to celebrate 9 years, which is, yeah, pretty cool thing, you know. It's an incredible thing, and, you know, on that anniversary day, you know, some people that maybe are new or haven't really had long-term sobriety might think that it was kind of filled with, I don't know, a sense of accomplishment, you know, or just kind of thinking back on, like, what I've done and wow, how far I've come, but that's just not the reality of it. Like today, this just comes naturally for me. It's just what I do on a daily basis. And I know that all of the knowledge and all of my experience from over those 9 years, it's great, but it doesn't really account for anything as far as like getting me another day tomorrow. You know, one of my favorite quotes in the Big Book is that we get this daily reprieve based on our spiritual condition. And it's just so true, and the reason I love it is because my definition of what that means in my sobriety has changed so drastically. Because in the beginning, you know, for the first couple years, really, I guess you could describe it as riding that pink cloud, but I went through this long period of sobriety and really just kind of felt like I can never see myself going back to drinking based on, like, what I'd been through and the knowledge I had gained of self and all of that, you know, and I just couldn't picture it, you know, and that's kind of what I thought that represented, you know. That daily reprieve based on my spiritual conditions. Like, just keep it green, remember where you came from. But as I've grown in sobriety, I've come to realize that my spiritual condition is directly dictated by where my spiritual action is, right? And for me, that means I gotta show up and do this thing on a consistent daily basis, and I constantly have to be working, right? Like, all sides of that triangle, the service, the unity, and the recovery, you know? And when I'm doing all of those things to the best of my ability, that's when my life is at its best, you know what I mean? And I really get free of this thing and I'm content, you know, is the bottom line of it. To get into my story a little bit, right, I had a very, I don't know, average childhood. I had a great childhood, you know, growing up. Neither of my parents drank. I didn't have any influence of drugs and alcohol. Like, when I was younger, just had a very average childhood. There was no abuse or trauma or anything that I point to that I say, you know, that was a contributing factor in why I became an alcoholic. The bottom line of it is, like it says in our doctor's opinion, you know, I drank solely because I loved the effect produced by alcohol. That's the bottom line. That's all there is to it, you know. And when I found alcohol, you know, I gravitated towards it quickly. And I found over a short period of time that I was willing to prioritize that over most things in my life, you know, over important things like my family and my health and goals and ambitions that I had, you know, whatever it be. And that was never my intention, really, right? You know, I felt like I came from a good moral background, like I was a good person, right? But I think what happens is there's just this disconnect, right, between me as an alcoholic and my intentions and my actions, right? Because my intentions may still be good, you know, they always are. But the thing is, when I'm sick and when I go through life over this extended period of time where I'm sort of arranging things on the outside, trying to manage my circumstances under the lens of this alcoholism, right? These behaviors and the way I perceive myself, it just seems natural to me. And, you know, looking at everybody else, it's just kind of like, if you knew what this did for me, you would understand the sacrifices and the compromises I have to make and why I act the way I am. But the world just sees me for my actions, right? The world sees me as unable to show up for life and just constantly coming short of the mark every single time, you know? That's the bottom line of it. You know, going through life, I found from a pretty young age, right, like getting into my adolescent years, I feel like I really got to this point where I just started to become, I don't know, you know, going through this sort of rebellious phase, having a lot of problems with like institutions and authority in my life. I just sort of, you know, I was raised with like some religious background. So from the get-go, like I kind of had that idea of a spiritual connection, like a higher power that worked in my life. But, you know, when I was a kid, that was like most people just contained to like foxhole prayers and whatever, when I was in a situation where I needed an outcome to sort of go my way, you know, shoot up a prayer. And that was really all it was. I didn't really feel like I had any connection to this higher power. And like I said, especially when I got into the adolescent years, you know, I started to take this attitude of like, you know, it talks about we agnostics where it's, we see religious people as weak, right? That's the way I felt. It was like, I don't need religion. I don't need this concept of a higher power to tell me how to live my life, dictate how I show up and what I'm supposed to do. I'm just going to take care of myself and I'm going to do what I need to do, because who knows better about what I need to do in my life than me, you know? And it was just, you know, full of pride and ego, you know? And I just developed that from a young age, and also just kind of learning to manipulate, you know, learning that if I go to school and I get the good grades and get the parents and the teachers off my back, and as long as I make everything kind of look good on the outside, I can, you know, behind closed doors, I can do whatever I want to do. Which at the time, you know, when I was a teenager, it was skateboarding and video games and stuff, but that's the way I lived my life, right? Like, I always gravitated towards the stuff that was external that poked me out of myself and made me feel better, and just tried to fill that void inside myself with that. And that behavior, frankly, would just follow through into my adult life, you know, when I would go and get jobs and stuff and happen to, you know, show up for work and just kind of do it to the best of my ability, make it seem like everything's okay on the outside, when in reality it's, you know, this alcoholism that I have going on. But I really didn't start drinking until a bit later, you know, by most people's standards. I remember smoking weed for the first time at like 15, and somewhere around there also having like a Thanksgiving get together where I finished all the wine glasses nobody else drank, and just kind of getting drunk for the first time, but didn't really have any kind of white light experience in those first initial phases where I gravitated towards it immediately. It wasn't until I was about in my senior year, you know, and I don't know what it was the circumstances of my life aligned, and that, you know, I already knew people that were partying and this kind of thing, and I just kind of started getting into it. And, you know, my descent into alcoholism just came like pretty hard and fast, because like it was just immediately, I always describe it like, you know, I was, when I found alcohol, it was like I found this thing that I've been looking for my entire life, and I didn't even know I was looking for it, you know, because I was always this, you know, kind of reserved, quiet kid, and, you know, all of a sudden I'm drinking, and it's like I have all these new friends, and I'm out, and I'm socializing, I'm talking to girls, I have a girlfriend now. And it was really just this coming of age time. It was that I had arrived moment, you know. Everything was just fun then, you know, as most people would say, you know, like we wouldn't have been in this phase if it wasn't fun in the beginning. And alcohol was very fun in the beginning. It really was. But pretty quickly, like, I started to experience smaller consequences as a result of my drinking. Like, I graduated from high school, and I worked over the course of high school. I went to the tech school, and I had this partnership to go to Drexel University afterwards, and I did that for a semester, and it wasn't really working out. Not necessarily that I couldn't even keep up the academic aspect of it, but I was just miserable because I was commuting down there, and I would just show up and do what I had to do, and then immediately get on the train and come back here so that I could be with my friends and I could party. And that was just so much more important to me at that time in my life than anything else, you know? So I dropped out of there, and I just, you know, decided I was just going to go, and I was going to get a job, and I was just going to basically party as much as possible. And that's all it was for like a couple years, a couple really just unremarkable years, was just kind of trying to party as much as I could and just try to have a good time. Like I said, it worked for a while, you know, and if I would have had any other way, it would have just gone on like that. You know, the problem is that my external circumstances, the world around me changes, right? As alcoholics, we don't really do too well with dealing with changes. And that's what happened is life started to catch up with me. It was like all of a sudden that girlfriend I'd been dating for a couple of years, she left. And like at that time, like I didn't really see it at the time, but when that happened, there was like a shift. There had been already like a shift in my drinking, right? Because I was no longer at that point, even at the age of like 20, I guess it was 21, 22. Like I was no longer drinking just because it was this social, enjoyable, fun thing. I was now drinking every day. And especially after that happened, it's like I'm drinking because I have all these feelings and all these problems that I don't want to deal with. And I don't know how else to react to it other than to just do what I do. You know, any interests I had or ambitions have kind of fallen by the wayside. And already at that point of like 22 years old, it was like alcohol and drinking and partying had just become so ingrained in the identity of who I was that that was just what I did, you know? So I just continued on with that, and it was just, you know, things just got progressively worse, you know? For the next couple of years, it was just always like one step forward, two steps back. It would always be suffering some kind of consequence as a result of my drinking, and always reacting with this kind of revolving door of fear, where it's like, you know, I'm drinking, and then I experience some kind of consequence as a result, whether it be like, you know, the incomprehensible demoralization, just like making a complete idiot of myself in a blackout, whether it be like a financial problem, whether it be wrecking a car, you know, like all of the things that happen to us, you know, just experiencing some kind of consequence. And then being full well convinced that it's like, okay, I just gotta pump the brakes here, kind of again, assemble the outside circumstances, make the people in my life kind of make it appear as if I'm doing okay, and you know, I'm gonna learn from that and move on. And then the fear creeps in, you know, of like, you know, not being able to drink, right? Because I don't have my sense of ease and comfort anymore. So eventually, sooner or later, it's like I'm gonna get back to that. And I didn't really understand that when I came, like, for basically the extent of my drinking career, was that we deal with this three-phase disease, right? Like I have this physical craving, right? When I put alcohol in my body, it's like I can't tell you how much I'm going to drink. And, you know, when I'm separated, it's just a matter of time until I drink again. I understood that part, right? But my thing was like every time I got past that, every time I got a couple of days under my belt, it's like, okay, I feel okay. I'm, you know, the physical aspect is okay. And I feel like I make that decision to pick up the drink again, you know. That's where I didn't manage to see the powerlessness, you know, because it always felt like I'm okay, I'm making this decision to go back, we're going to control and manage it this time, you know, it's going to be fine. I didn't really understand the mental obsession, right, which tells me that regardless of what's going on, regardless of how well I think I'm going to be able to control and manage when I go back, I'm always going to find my way back to a drink. And honestly, my alcoholism was always characterized by, it was never like swear off, like I said. You know, it was never like, I'm never going to drink again. It was always just like, I just got to, again, you know, just pump the brakes, kind of manage these external circumstances, deal with the consequences of my actions for a little while, and eventually we'll get back there. And frankly, that was the way it was when I ended up coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, which I'll get to, you know, shortly here. I mean, I guess the beginning of the end really happened when I was about 25 years old. And I moved out of my parents' house for the first time ever, right? Got my own apartment with a buddy of mine who was doing all the same exact things I was. And it was like at that point, it was just like the gloves were off because I didn't have any reason, any external circumstances really to kind of hide what I was doing and where the direction this thing was taking me. And over the course of the next 2 years or so, things just got progressively worse and worse. And again, that like aspect of drinking because it was fun, that started to go out the window. It was like, you know, it was at that point it was becoming the medicine. It was like I had to do what I had to do every single day, you know. And really in like that last year, I just always describe it as, the last year or two, it was like every single day, it was like I would get up and it was like from the time my feet hit the floor until I put my head on the pillow at night, it was like every bit of my existence, every bit of time, energy, money, every bit of my being went into this thing that was alcoholism in one way or the other. Just waking up, trying to figure out how I'm going to make it through these next 24 hours, doing what I have to do. And it was just miserable. There's no other way to put it. I mean, I never really got like suicidal per se, but I got very indifferent about life because I thought that this was just the hand that I was dealt in life, and I was just going to have to go on to the bitter end and try to, you know, manage that the best I could, which, you know, at the time, at the age of 27 years old, I figured if I was able to string it out over the course of another 10 or 15 years until the long-term effects of the lifestyle I was living caught up to me, as opposed to the short term, which would be dying of like an overdose or driving my car off a bridge or something like that. And that's just really what I thought life had in store for me at this point, because I just didn't see any way out at that point. You know, I certainly didn't think about AA, you know, which is funny because I had been introduced to the concept of a 12-step program when I was younger, frankly, like I think when I was 18, 19 years old. And again, like I said, the progression kind of onset pretty quickly. And my parents saw it and they were like, you need to go and do some of this outpatient treatment. So I was forced to do that at the, you know, threat of being homeless, which didn't sound good to me at the time. So I was exposed to a 12-step program, but I can tell you from that age of 18, 19 years old until I ended up in my first treatment center at 27, not one time did I think maybe I should try that AA thing again. And when I analyze that in retrospect, it's because I never conceded to myself that alcohol was really problematic in my life. I never thought that it was the alcohol problem. I always thought every time that it was going to be this situation where I would grow out of it, right? You know what I mean? Eventually something's going to happen. My circumstances are going to be going to change. And I'll be in a position in a different time and place where I won't keep, you know, experiencing all these consequences. I'll be able to drink and drug the way I want to drink and drug, and it'll be okay. But the reality is that I never grew out of it, right? Because this is a progressive and fatal illness. I always just grew into it. I never got to the point where I was able to better control and manage my drinking. It was just the consequences started catching up more and more quickly, and I just went down faster. But yeah, at the age of 27, I got arrested for my second DUI. So, you know, I, of course, by the intervention of law enforcement, because like I said, I never really saw a way where I was going to find my way here on my own. I was arrested for my second DUI and a host of other charges. And like any good alcoholic, my immediate reaction is to kind of do damage control and figure out what I have to do to kind of minimize the situation and you know, kind of do my time and figure out what I'm going to do from here. So I went to my lawyer and he advised me to go see, you know, a drug and alcohol specialist who advised me to go to inpatient treatment for the first time at 27 years old. So I agreed I would do that because, you know, basically because both of them said it would look good in the eyes of the court and this is what I needed to do. So it didn't sound good to me, but I knew I was in trouble and I agreed that I would do it. And when I ended up in that treatment center, man, what like a dark and uncertain time, right? That's the only way I can describe it. I used to have a member of my first home group, Tom C. He used to say in early sobriety, there was just a war going on in my head. And man, it was so true because I just had no idea what I was doing. It was like minute to minute, hour to hour. I'm just like trying to sort out where my intentions and my pride are and what's going on. Because on the one hand, it's like I feel pretty good about this. And it's like, okay, maybe this is the time and place where you kind of turn over a new leaf and really kind of take some of this stuff seriously and learn to, you know, go forward and not make any mistakes. But on the other side, I'm looking at the reality of the situation, which is like, this isn't for me, right? Like, if you understood me and my situation and who I am, like, this is not going to work for me. Like, a spiritual solution, this is not what I need, you know? So I was very, my surrender to this thing was very slow, certainly, because when I came in here, I really wasn't sold on it, and it was, you know, just going through the notions and really thinking that I could come in here and kind of pick and choose these parts of this program of recovery and apply them to my life as needed, is the bottom line of it. And that's what I did in the treatment center, right? I showed up at the treatment center and pretty quickly kind of learned the language, learned what you want me to say, you know, what I'm supposed to be saying to make you think that I don't really belong here. I'm actually, you know, going to come out of this thing and just kind of go back and manage my life just fine. You know, that's what it was. I always tell this story when I speak because it's just so representative of my time in treatment. And I was sitting there eating lunch or something, and one of the counselors is arguing with the kid, and he says, "Why can't you be more like this guy?" You know why? Because I don't even know this guy's name. He's at every group. He never causes any problems, you know. And that was me. You know what I mean? I just showed up there, and I was just, you know, I would like to say it was out of virtue, right, that I was committed to this thing, but it wasn't. Like I just, like I said, I just kind of wanted to act and make it look like I was a changed person, and it's like, oh, I got this, I can figure this out, you know, like I'm better. Again, making it look like on the outside, make the outside look a lot better than what's going on the inside, which is the reality, is that I'm terrified and no idea what's going to happen next, you know, and that's awful. But I stayed there, you know, and I would say that from the get-go, you know, when I got with my sponsor, he told me to be open-minded, honest, and willing. And I would say that I did that honestly from the get-go in rehab. I showed up at these groups, and they were talking a lot on alcoholism. And while there was a lot of this comparing me to you and how my situation isn't as bad as yours and this doesn't really apply to me wholeheartedly, I was willing to listen. I was willing to be open to this thing to the best of my ability and just kind of go forward from there. It came to like the end of my stay there, the end of my 30 days, and I was fully convinced that I was going to go back to where I was from, which was, you know, I was living in Montgomeryville at the time, and I thought I was just going to kind of go back. I was going to get my job back, you know, my crappy job that I had for 7 years that I only managed to keep by manipulating relationships with people, really. Get that back. It's like, I gotta get back. I got car bills piling up. I gotta pay my cell phone bill. You know, I had a girlfriend at the time. All these material things, right, that I think are, you know, my life, that define who I am, that were so important to me at the time, when in reality, I was dealing with like my life. Like I was on the verge of death, basically. You know what I mean? But of course, I'm concerned about all these external little things that I gotta go deal with. And I thought I was just going to go back to that, you know, go back to life. I would do some of the outpatient stuff and kind of go through my treatment program or whatever it be. And eventually, you know, just kind of pick back up where I left off, because that's what I always did. And they told me, I guess, about a week before I was supposed to leave, that they had been working with my family and they wanted me to go to the treatment center was out in Lancaster. And they told me that they wanted me to not go home, that they had been working with my family and they wanted to send me to a 90-day halfway house up in the Scranton area. And I was furious. You know what I mean? I was like, this is ridiculous. 90 days? Like, I'm not going to do it. I just did 30 days here. Like, I'm not doing another 90 days up at this place, you know, out in the middle of nowhere. And I was full well convinced that, like, when my family was coming, because this was a couple days before they had, like, the family visit, and I was full well convinced that when my parents came in, I was going to have to kindly deny them and say, you know, I appreciate it, but I can't do this. There's just, I got all these, again, external things I have to go take care of. Like, sorry. I went into it like that. And the only way I can describe it is like when they had that family visit and, you know, having that, I guess, that time of separation and actually seeing my mom and dad there, it was like, and having, talking with them, having them say, man, you look so good, you know, you're doing so well. I don't know, something just kind of broke inside of me, and it was like, I just couldn't, like, again, tell these people, like, refuse help from, you know, to tell everybody I got this, you know what I mean? Refuse the help, refuse these people who love me, that are trying to help me, you know what I mean, in every way, and say, no, I can't do this, I got this, I'll figure it out. So I ended up agreeing to go to this place, you know, begrudgingly, of course. And in retrospect, that's where my journey in sobriety really started, you know. I got to this place, I started getting to know some of the people in the house, some of the guys that worked there. Some of the guys that worked there had, like, you know, obviously some couple of years of sobriety, several of them, and getting to know them and talking to them and hearing their stories and how they had been through situations very much like mine, you know, but they seemed really happy and sober and contented in their sobriety and doing pretty well in life. And I was, you know, obviously I'm starting to, like, maybe there's something to that, but still, you know, pretty resistant to this whole thing. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't think I needed a sponsor. I was required to get a sponsor if I was going to live there, but I tried to not get a sponsor for basically the first 3 weeks, which was not flying. Because I didn't want a sponsor because I thought, you know, going into it, I'm thinking, like, a sponsor is just, like, another, again, like, figure of authority, right? It's like, I already got the judges, I already got my parents, I already got, like, all these people kind of hovering over me, watching how I'm doing, telling me what I need to be doing. It's like, I don't need a sponsor who's just going to tell me what I need to do to get sober. That was my conception of, like, sponsorship, right? Because sponsor's job is to tell you what to do, get you sober, right? I've come to realize that that's not what a sponsor does, right? It's not a sponsor's job to get me sober. A sponsor definitely doesn't have the power to get me sober, you know? It's a sponsor's job to share their experience with me and explain how they were able to form this conscious relationship with a higher power of their understanding and start practicing spiritual principles in their life that will allow them to have this thing we call a spiritual awakening, which will allow me to stay sober. That's what I've realized in retrospect, but you know, I got to this place, and like I said, I'm kind of just getting to know people in the first couple weeks, and, like, as far as the steps go, like, in the treatment center, it was like, okay, step one, it's like, I'm powerless over alcohol, right? Like, I'm in a treatment center at 27 years old, I've lost my job, I've, like, you know, I have nothing to show, no money in the bank account, I have nothing to show for myself in my life. It's like, it's pretty evident that I'm powerless over alcohol, right? Step two, again, like, I had this conception, oh, higher power from when I was younger, and I didn't really know how to, like, connect to that or anything, but I had the willingness, you know what I mean? And kind of getting to step three, that's where I sort of got, I feel like I got stuck, because it's like, turn my will and my life over, like, what does that look like in my life? How do I do that, you know? And I remember being at this meeting after being at this halfway house for, like, 3 weeks, and it's a big book meeting, and they read a passage from the big book, I think it's in How It Works, where it says, this is where we go from having a spiritual experience to a spiritual awakening, right? And there's just this point of surrender in me, and I look at it now as this, like, third step experience, but there was just this point of surrender where I was like, I have no idea, like, what that means. Go from having a spiritual experience to a spiritual awakening. Like, what even is that? Like, I have no idea what that looks like in my life. But again, I'm in this meeting, and all these people that I've gotten to know over these past couple of weeks who seem like they're pretty content with themselves and their sobriety are sharing about how they have had that exact experience of going through that. And so I said it was this point of surrender for me, because I was finally at that point, I was like, maybe there's something to this, you know, and I may not have this vision for myself of how this is going to play out and how it's going to work. But these people seem convinced that if I just follow these steps and I give this thing a shot, that will produce itself in my life. And it was just such an important thing, because I think that's so much about what that third step in this program is being able to suspend my own disbelief and come to terms with the fact that I can have this higher power in my life that I don't fully understand and can't explain, and just place trust in that higher power and believe that if I just do the right things, that, you know, this process is going to play out and the answers are going to be revealed to me as and when I need them. Not on my time, but on God's time, right? And then I'll be taken care of, you know, as long as I continue to do the next right thing and I try to do this to the best of my ability and trust in that higher power, which I don't understand, right? And I can tell you at 9 years sober, I know just as much, if not less, about God than I did that night at that meeting, right? That's the whole how and why of this thing. It's like, I'm not supposed to be able to define what God is and isn't, you know what I mean? I have to seek that, you know what I mean? And then, like I said, it's just this process of seeking is what gets me there, you know? I just have to try to do to the best of my ability to do God's will, what it is for me, you know? And by practicing spiritual principles, I start to kind of see what that is, and it comes more naturally to me over time. But that certainly wasn't the case in the beginning, of course. So like I get it said, I ended up getting a sponsor, I think shortly after that. I asked this guy to be my sponsor, and I was in this place, but it was largely I was 27 at the time, and they specialized kind of in like adolescence and stuff, so it was a lot of younger guys, like 16 to 20 years old was kind of like most of the demographic there, and even the guys that were working there were, younger than me, you know what I mean? These were guys that were like 23 or so, and they had like years of sobriety already, and I was like, I hit a roadblock on that with the sponsorship, of course, because I was like, I need a sponsor that's exactly like me, right? I can't get a guy to sponsor me that's younger than me. He doesn't have the life experience. He hasn't been through what I've been through, right? So I ended up asking this guy that was a little bit older than me. He worked there. He was like, he would come in and clean the place once a week. He was a good friend of the guy that owned it. I ended up asking him to be my sponsor because he was a little bit older, and I was like, okay, maybe I'll be on the same wavelength as this guy. But like getting to meet him, I come to hear his story, and you know, he's like, he just has alcohol in his story. I have like the drugs as my part of the story. So I'm like, well, he's not really going to understand and relate in that aspect. He was like a family man. He had been married and he had like a couple kids. And I was like, again, not really my experience. You know, he had been a pharmacist coming in. It was just all this stuff where I'm just like, this guy's like, he's not going to understand. We're not going to be able to work through this thing. Like, we don't really line up. He's not really going to understand where I'm coming from. And he's not going to be able to like, you know, like, see my situation, you know, differentiating myself, of course, you know. And it didn't take long of, like, working through the book to kind of start to break down those walls and realize that, you know, just reading through that book and reading about the feelings of, like, him talking about this is the way I felt when I went through this experience, it was kind of, like, really broke down those walls for me to be like, oh, you know, I kind of relate to that. I understand what he's talking about there, you know. And again, just helped me kind of shed a lot of selfishness and thinking that I'm, you know, this special snowflake who needs this special, very special sobriety, you know, that this simple program is not going to be applicable for my situation that you don't understand. You know, just helped me kind of break down that wall, you know, and trust in someone else really was what it was, you know, trust in someone else and kind of being willing to listen to what they had to say and give me instructions on like how to work through this thing. In the end, we got into, you know, the step work pretty quickly. He had me start on like a fourth step. It's funny. I just came from a meeting that I was chairing and had a speaker on the fourth step. And, she talked about, she was like, you know, I had a ton of resentments on my fourth step. And I was thinking that I was like, yeah, I had a ton of resentments too, you know, and my thing was like, I really wanted to seek out those justified resentments, right? Like those ones where it's like, I don't really have much part in it. It was just wrong. It was done to me. And I think looking back on that, it was a lot of like me trying to, you know, rely on my self-knowledge and still being full of pride and ego. Again, I have like 60, 90 days at this time. And a lot of trying to poke holes in this program, right? You know, it's like if you have a justified resentment, it's like that one's okay. I can keep that one sort of thing. You know, and I found out after working through that process that it doesn't really matter whether I have this justified resentment or not. Or like it's the same with fears, right? It's like alcoholics, like a lot of us come in here with sort of justified type fears of, you know, suffering consequences as a result of what we've done, you know, like going to jail or you know, maybe the spouse isn't going to come back or give me another chance this time. You know, these real fears of that we have to face as a result of like the things we've done. And working through that fourth step, it really kind of gave me this perspective on like, it doesn't really matter where that resentment's coming from. It doesn't matter if there's some justification to it. The only thing that matters is like, I need to get free of that thing on my end or else I'm going to suffer. I'm going to constantly be tortured by that, you know? And that was really the how and why of that whole fourth step for me is, right? It's like, I can only change my perspective on things. And it really allowed me to kind of step back and objectively look at the person that I was and how, you know, how my mind was operating and these thoughts and actions, these things I do and how they just play their way out into all of my relationships and situations in life and just create conflict, you know? I'm constantly in conflict with all of these external relationships and situations in my life, and it's all driven by these character defects, right? You know, it's all just that. And I'm just running around just constantly in conflict with life, and the only way for me to do that is to change my perspective, right? Because the outside world isn't going to change, you know what I mean? All those people, all those situations are going to be there, whether I'm sober or not, whether I'm ready to deal with them or not. And that fourth step, you know, allowed me to, again, get that objective perspective on myself and these character defects and how they play their way out in my life. And armed with that knowledge, you know, this book says here are some of these spiritual principles that you can use to kind of work on these character defects. And again, when I come into this program, right, like I've been living on these things for so long, being selfish, dishonest, full of fear. That's the way I live my life. That's what comes naturally to me. But with the knowledge of that, of those character defects, and given these spiritual principles, I get like this new way of kind of reaching out and starting to deal with that on a daily basis, you know, little by slowly kind of stepping back and looking at situations and where's my wrong at and how can I do this better? And is this resentment creeping up and all that stuff that plays into it on a day-to-day basis? Like, what can I do to react in a spiritual way with this, you know, be better about it and not just kind of constantly do what I've always done, you know? So that's what came out of that fourth step for me. I mean, in short, you know, it just gave me that change of perspective. And I just remember, you know, as many people say, after working through that fourth step, that's where I really started to get like some peace. You know what I mean? Like I really just started to feel like it came in like intervals, like here and there when I would go to AA meetings and I would get a little bit of this like hope and feel like, yeah, I feel pretty good about this. Like, you know, just a little bit of hope that I could kind of work my way through this thing and maybe sort of get this change of perspective and maybe kind of go through life and do this sobriety thing. And after working through that fourth step, that's when like I just started to feel good. You know what I mean? I was okay. Like most people say, it was like this weight was lifted off my shoulders and I just had this change in perspective. And it was like, you know, it was a powerful thing, you know, of course. On the outside, right, I stayed at that, halfway house for 90 days. I worked through the steps with a sponsor in that time. It came time to leave and I ended up moving into a sober house, which was owned by my sponsor. A guy from my home group helped me get a job. It was just such an example of like AA doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. You know what I mean? Like people just reached out and they just made themselves available and helped me out and put me in a position to succeed. Like everybody, home group members, guys at this halfway house, everybody was just willing to reach out and just help me. You know what I mean? With expecting nothing in return, just out of like the virtue of this program, like as I see now, just like helping out a newcomer and put them in a position to succeed. And I just had so like, it's crazy because when I look back on my experience getting sober, it's like I was so lucky on so many things, right? Like I had this family that was willing to help me and I was able to go to a treatment center and all this stuff that at the time I thought was like an obstacle. Right? That I thought was like, oh my gosh. And it's like, I was so lucky. I was so blessed at the time to have so many people in life that were willing to reach out and to help me. You know what I mean? Because not everybody that gets sober has those kind of luxuries and go through, frankly, circumstances that are a lot worse than mine, you know? And I finally started to just shed some of that selfishness and realize that people were helping me out and just try to make myself available to AA and start contributing from the get-go. And frankly, from the time I got out of that halfway house, I got involved with a home group right away. I started showing up, trying to do service work. I would show up early. I would stay late and do the trash or like empty the coffee pot, whatever they needed. You know, I immediately got involved with this great group of guys who just helped me out so much in the beginning. And I didn't do much talking in the beginning, but they were a great group of guys and they had a ton of knowledge to share. And I showed up there on a weekly basis and I really learned about how I was going to be able to do this thing moving forward in sobriety. And it was, you know, I just hit the ground running with it. It was great, man. You know, I stayed at that sober house for a while. I mean, when I was about 8 months sober, my younger brother passed away pretty much like as a direct result of untreated alcoholism. And that obviously was one of the most difficult things that I've had to deal with in my life and my sobriety, like for sure. And I could obviously talk about many different areas of my life that's affected, be it my relationship with my family and higher power. But as far as how it affected like my sobriety, I would say, again, it helped me shed some selfishness for sure. Because at that time, like I was 8 months sober and I felt really good and I was doing a lot of the right things. I felt like I really had a shot at this thing, but there was always this like, there was still like kind of that obsession in my head, like creeping, just like, I'm feeling really good. But I don't know if I was like in a vacuum, if all this was removed, I feel like I would probably want to drink again. You know, there was like still that little bit of desire. Like, I don't know, there was still a little bit of a desire to drink. And I felt guilty about that, right? Because it's like all these people are giving up themselves to help me. And I kind of still, there's still a little bit of that, you know? And I think when that happened, it just helped me shed some of that because it was just like, I realized that the whole how am I this thing is that I don't have to go at it by myself, basically, right? And in that situation, it was like, you know, it's like intuitively learning how to handle situations which used to baffle us. Like I would have had no idea how to show up and be available for that situation before, but I just did it. You know what I mean? I went there and I showed up and I worked through that grief and I was there for my family and I was present and I did, you know, and that's just what happened. I learned how to do that and it just came to me and I did the best I could to work my way through that, you know? And when I look back on it now, you know, it's like, it's above my spiritual pay grade to say why some people make it and some people don't, you know? My brother was, you know, he was graduated from Temple, was successful, graduated from Temple with an engineering degree, was on the football team, like all these things. He was like very successful and I was just kind of like the black sheep and just kind of kept things, just everything. And I'm here and he's not. The only thing I can make of that is that, you know, there's some kind of purpose in that, right? And when I look at it, it's like, when we come in here to Alcoholics Anonymous, right, we go through all this hardship. We go like, you know, we go to the darkest depths and we just don't know how we're going to get out of it. We can't ever see that. And I come here and I've been through all of this terrible stuff and I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and it's like, by working through this program, it's like, not only do I get free of that, not only do I learn how to deal with all that, those greatest hardships become my greatest asset. You know what I mean? It's like I can now take that, and that's now something, a tool that I've been equipped with by God to go forth and to help and to heal other people in the world. And that's really like what I took away from that situation is like, all I know is that that happened, and you know, that's the tool that God's given me to go forward and deal with people. And you know, I would encourage anybody, if anybody's going through a situation like that, I'd talk to you after the meeting, but it's just I worked that into my primary purpose, you know, and I really like hate to saying that it's like some people don't have to make it for us to succeed or whatever it is, because I don't feel like, you know, that was a driving force, but you know, do I have people in my life that I feel are sober supports? That's very important to me that they're around. Yeah, absolutely. Like my brother's been sober longer than I have. I have another younger brother. He's been sober longer than I have. One of my best friends ended up actually going to that area up in Scranton, and he was the one that I lived with for years, and was just absolutely took me to the darkest places. You know what I mean? We were just there together, and he ended up getting sober there about a year after I got up there, and I rebuilt this relationship with him, and that really like changed my perspective to see someone that I knew so personally when we were just at our worst and watch them just kind of turn their life around. I mean, that just changed the whole thing for me. Cause prior to that, I was displaced into this whole new environment, this whole bubble where everybody that I got to know was sober. And then just being able to watch somebody and likewise with my brother, just turn their life around and see what they used to be like. And those guys are both still sober today. So like, you know, it's just an important thing, you know. You know, going forward, you know, I got that year of sobriety, which was very important. You know, it felt good. You know, I continued on with the program. Things happened in those subsequent years two and three. All these like first in sobriety, I moved out into an apartment, you know, I did all the things that happened, like going to weddings, going to sporting events, going to concerts, like I did all these things, and I remember just going into all those situations and thinking like, it's going to be so weird kind of doing this without drinking, right? Like again, coming into the program, I thought like, how am I going to be able to have fun? How am I going to be able to enjoy sobriety, right? And going into those situations, it's like, is this going to be weird? And every single time I would come out the other side and I'd be like, man, I had a really good time doing that. And it wasn't weird. You know, people didn't think it was weird that I wasn't drinking. And it just showed me how like, as the alcohol gets like, the alcohol becomes paramount to everything else, right? Like I can't picture life situations just being, you know, being contented with that on a normal basis, you know, and I experienced all that stuff. And it's like today I realized we had a speaker a couple of weeks ago and I thought he put it so well. You know, he would say, I used to think drinking and alcohol was awesome, right? Like it was so much fun. And sobriety has shown me that life is awesome and fun. I just wasn't able to experience it because I was stuck up here. And it's so true. You know what I mean? Because I obsess over this thing that is alcohol. And once I'm finally removed from it and I'm able to practice these spiritual principles and get this normal life, things just, I'm able to go anywhere and enjoy life today, you know? And that's really been my experience as time has progressed on. After being up there for a couple years, I guess I was up there for like 3.5 years. I had an opportunity. I had like a job offer back down here. I had the opportunity. I was faced with the opportunity to leave this kind of bubble, this group, this foundation that I had established up there in Scranton and come back down here, which was a tough decision at the time. And looking back on it, it was kind of important because it was the first time that you know, I felt like the work I had put in with AA had put me in a position where I could make this decision, which was kind of better for my life, which wasn't necessarily better for my sobriety, which is a slippery slope, but I felt good about it at the time. And I would love to say I came down here and did what everybody tells you to do, which was immediately do what I did up there, which is get involved with the home group and, you know, kind of build this community in AA down here. But my experience in the beginning was I would show up, and again, I had 3.5 years sober, felt like I pretty much had this under my belt. And I would show up to one meeting a week, which was my now home group, the Conscious Contact Speaker Group. I would show up 2 minutes before the speaker would start, and I would stay for my half hour of sobriety and soak it up, and then I would leave as soon as it was over. And I did that for like 6 months or so, and I started to get really miserable. And I was just focusing on myself all the time, just working this new job, working overtime, kind of building things up for myself, and I started getting miserable. And luckily, my good friend, Ron, at the Conscious Contact Speaker Group, he you know, reached out to me at one point and said, why don't you come over to a big book study at my house? You know, and he invited me over there, and I went over there, got to know some of the guys that I would see at the meetings. He asked me, why don't you just show up early? Why don't you, like, put on a suit? Because if you've ever been there, we suit up and show up. Said, why don't you throw on a suit and show up there and greet people before the meeting? You know, and slowly I started to get acclimated back to that service, you know, in AA. And man, it just made all the difference. You know, in short order, I just started to get very involved, started going to other meetings and just form those relationships, you know, and just got back to it basically, you know. And honestly, you know, my sobriety has been characterized by different intervals of that over time, you know, like when COVID hit, it was the same thing, right? COVID hit and I couldn't go to the meetings anymore and I just kind of let it fall by the wayside. I tried doing the Zoom thing, but it fell by the wayside. And when I look at it, it was a very selfish approach because I was like, I'm not getting what I want out of the meetings, right? I'm not getting the socialization. I'm not getting the interaction with people. But when I look on it, that was selfish because I forgot about my primary purpose, right? It's like, I'm supposed to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. That's what it's about. Like, I didn't make myself available, go out of my way to make myself available during that time to try and seek out people that needed this message, you know? And that was another time in my life where it just kind of, you know, things slowed down. You know, and yeah, it's been up and down, you know, like my experience has just been, it's been incredible. I mean, I moved back down here, I got the job. The last 2 years I was living out in Colorado because I left my job to kind of pursue a degree, which was like another thing. And when I was out in there, again, the same thing kind of happened. I wasn't deeply involved in AA, and you know, I moved back about 6 months ago, and I will say that the last 6 months I've been about as deeply involved in AA than I have been in years. I've been hitting a meeting every single day, and I've just gotten involved with service. You know, I've been going into institutions trying to carry this message. I went to two last week going in there, and it's just made all the difference, man. It's like I said at the beginning, like, I can get by on AA just doing like the bare minimum sometimes and just kind of try to rely on that, rely on my recovery and rely on the time I have. But it's like, how do I want to live? How free do I want to be? And when I show up here on a daily basis and I'm getting outside myself and I'm trying to help other people and try to be of service to AA here and present, that's when my life is at its best, you know? And luckily it really has been that way for the past 6 months or so. Starting to run out of time here. I'll just touch on more about like what it's like today. I mean, you know, I try to maintain like a healthy fear of relapse, right? That's like something that I like to talk about because like my experience with AA, when I came in here at 27, I went through this process and I never relapsed, right? And I remember there was this guy who lived up there in Scranton and he would talk about his experience with relapse and he would say, you know, I was sober for like 9 years, which I'm sober for 9 years now. And he would say, you know, things were going good. And I went out, I believe it was to a football game with some buddies and they were getting some drinks and he said, I'm going to get one. And he had a drink that night, you know, and he said the worst thing that could possibly happen happened and that was nothing, right? Like nothing happened. I didn't get in a fight. I didn't get arrested. And everything was okay, you know, and I always identify with that because I know that that's me today. I'm able to listen to other people and hear my story and their story because that would be me, right? Like when I go out there, I it would be like, maybe it's not the first time, maybe it's not the second time, but that mental obsession is going to creep in and it's just going to be like, I'm going to know, I'm going to think about it. I'm going to say, when's the next time I'm going to drink? And I know in short order, those intervals are going to get shorter and shorter and a short amount of time, as my experience has shown, because this disease is progressive, alcohol is just going to become the most important thing in my life. And I just don't want that to happen today, you know? I just have so many things in my life that are more important to me than that. I have this spiritual way of life, and I get, you know, my health is good, and I have relationships with people and my family. And it's just an incredible thing that I've been able to experience. I'll just close. I usually like to close just by saying, you know, my experience with AA in a nutshell is that when I came in here, I was absolutely at my lowest point, my darkest hour. And I showed up here in AA and I just saw a little bit of hope, you know what I mean? Like this little bit of hope that maybe if I work this thing in my life, I could have this contented sobriety that they were promising. And really, I've just tried to do to the best of my ability to hang on to that and to do things that are suggested to me and show up for AA and try to help the next person out, you know. And I get an incredible life as a result of it is really the only way I can put it. But that's about all I got. Thanks. I'm Brian. I'm back on the whole lot.